Hello, hello, everyone. Good morning, good evening, and good afternoon, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Verimed Stories podcast. I am your host, Francesca Pinillo, and in this week's episode, I have two guests with me today, and we're going to talk about our relatively new up-and-coming business unit, which is EVG, and that stands for Evidence and Value Generation. So with me today, I have Amy Mulick, who heads this business unit, and I also have with me Marius Severdine, who is our senior statistician in Verimed and also within this business unit, EVG. So welcome, Amy and Marius. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode. How are you both doing today?
Yeah, pretty good. Thank you very much for having us.
You are more than welcome. So let's get into the episode then. As I said, today is all about EVG. So Amy, I think I'll start with you. Tell me what EVG is all about.
Well, when I tell people what EVG is, I say generally, we do all of the statistical analyses for research for drugs that do not exist in the clinical trials. So anything outside of a standard clinical trial analysis we might do. So that includes post-marketing, safety analyses, long-term effectiveness, HTA submission analyses, and we do real-world evidence at any stage of the life cycle of a drug.
So like when we talk about EVG, like me, I'm within a launch team. So the work that I do is obviously using, you know, the phase three or even the phase two clinical trial data, but is after those trials are finished. And I take it that's, you know, a lot of what EVG sits in is like that launch space as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Quite a lot of us do sit in the launch space and the HTA space. Mm-hmm. We're a team of about 10, 11 folks, and I'd say 70 to 80% are in that launch area or market access.
Yep. And Marius, you yourself, what is like your expertise within this EVG business unit?
Mm-hmm. I think my expertise also is in the launch and especially in the HTA area. So preparing all the data and the evidence that we need to get a successful submission into the European market. Germany is a big thing, of course. Mm-hmm. The new changes in EU HTA legislation is a big topic. But I also do what Amy just mentioned, like taking phase two, phase three study data and trying to extract the kind of evidence that we would need later for submission.
I know with yourself, Marius, recently you did a webinar as well that was HT related, and that was on the I'm going to get this wrong, the EU NETA,
yeah,
which is going to be a new thing that's going to affect a lot of different places.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was kind of like in collaboration with Arsaling Yol from who's also in the PSI special interest group on HTA statistics. And so UNETA is kind of like a synonymous thrown around with the new EU HTA legislation. So this is going to be a change where we're going to shift in the EU from every country having their own approach, having their own data collection and their own kind of like requirements for evidence, trying mm-hmm. to unify it and to make sure that most sponsors only have to do like one data collection, one evidence synthesis, and then every country can use that evidence to kind of like draw their own conclusions. And so that's going to be like, of course, a big change. Everyone is really excited about that. And we try to add a bit more clarity and to have everybody kind of like take the edge off this big upcoming change.
Yeah, and I definitely think that's an exciting time for us in, you know, evidence generation and in the launch space who work on HTA dossiers.
Absolutely. And I really like want to kind of go back what Amy said before, like describing what is EVG actually. And I think like we had a great discussion a while ago, like what is it that makes our studies kind of like stand out from clinical studies? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great question, because it is also kind of like the question, why do some people of us land here in HTA statistics and not in clinical statistics?
Yeah.
I'm seeing there are some like really interesting projects that we get to do that you wouldn't necessarily get to do if you do clinical statistics. Yep. And so that's kind of different, I think, us from the, like, I call it regular clinical statistics, yep. But yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Those of us who've come here tend to like to explore things. You know, we don't work with randomized data, which is what clinical trial statisticians work with. And with randomized data, you can easily make comparisons that are free of bias and have quite easy and interpretations that have been spelled out in the statistical analysis plan. But with the type of analysis we do, we sometimes don't work with randomized data, or we work with randomized data but have to break the randomization for some reason. And so we have to do more complicated statistical analyses to get around that. And it's not so straightforward, but it's quite fun if you're statistically minded. And so those of us who get attracted to this kind of work, I think we have quite curious minds and we like to look into these types of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know for myself, that's how I found myself in the launch space, is because I like the creativity that comes with our role. It is very variable and there are lots of different projects. You know, like one project I'm working on, you know, a utility analysis that utilizes mixed models. You know, there's another project that I could be using, you know, a different like network meta-analysis, for example. You know, there's just lots of different things that you can do. And I think that's what's really special about the work that we do, especially as you said, Amy, as statisticians, where just naturally you're curious and you want to explore.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think like it's really impossible to draw a line in terms of the data we use or the methods we use, because it could be anything. It could be randomized, not randomized, could be this method, that's method. But it's just whatever the evidence requires, we kind of find a way to provide that. And that, as you mentioned, Francesca, is kind of a creativity. Yep. You have more freedom, but you also have to come up with great ideas to provide that evidence. And we also have a project right now where we try to create a surrogacy analysis. We try to get image EOS data. We're going to simulate over survival using real world data to kind of like what would have happened. And these kind of things, is you're not going to get that asked in usual clinical trials for EMA submission, because they have too much strict guidelines usually for that. But in creating evidence for submissions, and that's, you got a bit more freedom. And I gotta say, one other thing is using that phase three data to create submissions for countries. As I mentioned, we have, every country has a different mindset, different bar for evidence, different like style, how they required or what they're looking for. So you have the same study that you get from phase three, but you have like 15 different kinds of evidence you have to create from the same data set. So you have to get creative and you have to change it around. And so that makes it really special and really interesting.
Yeah. That's our evidence generation. Yeah. We work on how we can, in a principled way, generate evidence from non-traditional sources. And yeah, that was a good summary.
Yep, prime example. And I think like with our team at Verimed, what I'll come at it from this angle is that being that type of statistician, you're still never going to know absolutely everything. So like, even though you're a statistician, every single one of us is expertise in, you know, a small percentage of statistics, right? And I think like what's good about us having this business unit in Verimed is that we can help rely on each other. We can upskill each other, because I might be, you know, the more of the expertise and cost utility analysis, but Marius, yourself, you might have the NMA expertise, and someone else might have, you know, another type of project that they have gained that knowledge in. So while we have to, you know, be innovative and come up with different ideas, I think it's really amazing that this business unit has brought us all together, because we now can, you know, borrow that information from lots of different brains, not just, you know, myself or you. Like, we can utilize everything that we have.
Absolutely. And I think we like to do that too. I mean, I myself have asked, when I was doing a review for a propensity score analysis. I asked for anyone who had experience working with it and got all kinds of great ideas and some resources and direction to some papers to look at. And I've recently seen that done with, I think it was a utility analysis. And if someone needs a paper and someone has access to it from a perhaps an academic login they have, still have, we're great at sharing resources. I think that's something really special about our team, because we're big enough but small enough that we have the breadth of experience that we can share, small enough that we can be quite intimate with sharing it and know each other one-to-one pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, I think I... it's also a bit cheesy, but I think that really ties to the environment values that actually, like, I mean, integrity, collaboration, and excellence. And the collaboration part is something, I mean, I've worked in bigger CROs, like multinational companies, and where you also usually would expect that you could find someone with every expertise, but it's hard to find that person, and it's hard to get them agree to help you, because they ask, yeah, but you're a different business unit. I mean, how do I build that? I mean, is it really possible? And I see with Runway, it's like, Amy, I think you need it. It's the perfect size. Is that we large enough that we have for every topic, we have someone with expertise, but we're small enough that you actually can meet that person. They are usually open to actually help you. And I love that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what's really special about our team, is that we all know each other. And if you do have a question, we have like our own workspace where we can ask a question and, you know, 100% you're going to get a response from someone, and everyone has time for you as well. I think sometimes, like as a statistician, when you don't know something, it's quite a strange feeling, because you're considered to be, you know, the all-knowing being of statistics. And I think it's really nice that we can just ask these questions of each other and be able to borrow on that knowledge and borrow that expertise from each other, because then you upskill yourself and you become a better statistician from that collaboration. But I think communication, no matter where you are, is such an important aspect of any team.
And I think that's a really great point. It's okay to not know something. And I think what really makes someone like a special good statistician is admitting that you don't know something and being able to learn that. And always be totally honest about stuff that I don't know, but I always assure that I'm pretty good at learning and teaching myself. And I got a bit of a strange career landing here in statistics. I worked with environmental statistics since the beginning, and my master's actually in the beginning was in environmental science before I switched to epidemiology and statistics. And so I had a job which was really comfortable and in a topic which I was really, really good at. And the thing is, there was no really development, no really changes. And I thought, okay, I can comfortably do that for the next few years, but it stops exciting me. And so I was lucky that I could do the change now more to the, as many years back, to clinical statistics. And I, when I realized this is something where you'll never be done, is as soon as you know something, there's a new paper, there's new development, there's a new evidence coming around, and there will never be a point in your career where you have to stop learning. And for me, that's totally exciting, because I love when something changes and you have new developments. I mean, you have new hot topics coming up, externally controls, network meta-analysis, propensity scores. And the industry shifts all the time. And for me, that was, okay, I found my home. I want to do that. I don't want to be bored anytime in the future. And so I think that's part of admitting that you don't know something and learning it is for me, like, central part of why I love what I do.
Yeah. I feel so inspired now.
And I have to second that, because I could have said exactly the same thing myself. I think that one thing that is great is that there is always something to learn. It's always evolving. AI is the next big thing that's going to probably quite fundamentally change the way we do our work. It won't eliminate our jobs, I don't think, but it will probably in the next 5 years or so change considerably how we do them. And so if I was to give some advice to a young person now, it would be what you just said, Marius. Be curious. Admit you don't know if you don't know an answer, and say, but I will find out. That's I mean, 99 times out of 100, I'm struggling to think of that one time out of 100 where it might be the opposite, but 99 times out of 100, that's all anybody wants, is someone to help them get through, you know, work through this problem with them. Because, you know, if you're looking for the one person who has an answer to your specific problem, you will never find them.
Mm. And I feel like as statisticians, we're allowed to give each other that little smidge of uncertainty. That's allowed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like Amy, your background, just to touch on that a little bit, I find really interesting because you've came into, you know, into Vermed, into this industry. You are in the industry, but you came from a very like academic background. So how do you feel that like has changed from going from academia into, you know, into industry?
It's a good question. It's a different feel, you know, there's a different orientation. I came from a largely public health, well, not public health, more epidemiology, a bit of public health background, which is not focused on medications particularly, unless you're looking at classes of medications. So really what I was looking at was exposures before, and now we're looking at drugs, which is a different orientation. And also there's a much more structured approach to looking to analyzing things. Mm-hmm. There's a SAP written for everything and followed to the T and documented when it's deviated. And you might be surprised to know it's not necessarily the same in academia. SAPs are written. They're quite often deviated from a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not randomly, they're discussed, but they're not documented and filed and archived in a retrievable way all the time. So I think it's been quite different just, you know, learning about the standards here, working with data on medications that are going to be given to humans, and learning how to use different statistical software. But these are all minor details. You know, we're still talking about the same statistical methods. We're still talking about working with a wide variety of different people, different stakeholders, people with backgrounds in medicine, backgrounds in epidemiology, scientists, statisticians, all kinds of different stakeholders. So there's actually a lot that's the same. It's just the little technical pieces that you need to learn. So it's been interesting, and I've been hopefully getting there over the past year.
Just to touch on something you mentioned, actually, which I think is a really big thing in our job, like in the launch space and in EBG, as stakeholders, because as statisticians, we need to be able to, you know, convey what we're doing to people who are not statistically minded. So like physicians and medical affairs, like when it comes to thinking strategically for market access, like we as statisticians still need to put different hats on, I think. But I think that's what's really good about the space that we're in, is that we actually get opportunities to speak to lots of different people. Like we get to understand why it's relevant from the physician, right? But we get to understand how it actually goes into the payer story from market access. So I feel like EVGs are really like interesting one to be part of, because you get different chances to learn other skills that are not quite statistics.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Couldn't have said that better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I also sometimes make the experience like when we support submissions to countries that we have like responsible persons for each country who's kind of like actually managing the resubmission. So they know what evidence that country typically wants, because they have to know that country's health and public health system in and out, know like kind of what evidence would be necessary. Because, you know, every submission is based on a health system. So submission for UK is both based on the UK health system, and for Germany on the German system. So that's why you need someone who knows that country in and out to kind of really let us know what evidence we should request. But this is usually not a statistician. It's kind of someone with public health knowledge or physician. So they kind of like give us a list of evidence, and we have to find out how we can provide that with the clinical data we have. So that's where you kind of have the communication between, okay, can we actually do that? And if we are able to do that, then we have to find out, okay, where's the data, and how do we manage that? And do we have to find external data? Do we have to enter a paper? And this finding the evidence and communicating it to non-statistician that's definitely interesting, and it's definitely a new challenge, which is really really cool. You start to rethink what you usually just take for granted if you talk to a statistician, and then you have to just translate. Okay, what does it mean actually if I have to put it in lay language?
I had a nice piece of advice given to me from my old boss in academia. Whenever she would apply for a big grant, she would put all her ideas on one page and then take it to her 5-year-old son and say, this is my idea. This is what I want to get money for to do my research. What do you think? And if she could convey it to him in a way that he understood, then she knew that she was on the right track.
Yep, that's
a really good idea.
Yeah, really, really good advice. I would just hope that they would say yes. I was like, if my son likes it, then you know the grant proposal will be perfect.
We'll put it in the footnote.
Well, if he says no, you just go back and do it again.
By the way, my 5-year-old was approving it, so you can just skip to the end and say yes.
Yes, give me the money. My 5-year-old likes it. We approved.
Yeah. But I always had to think of something else which is different in academia. And I did later in my career like another master in epidemiology, and I still had a bit of tie to that university and occasionally like visiting courses. And it was really interesting to see what kind of like academia was working on. And so they had a very great talk where we talked about quality in programming. Mm. And the basic, they talked about a paper which mentioned code review as a great new tool to kind of improve quality in academia. And I was sitting there, I think, yeah, that's really innovative for you, having someone else look at your code and see if you messed something up.
Yeah.
And I thought it couldn't be further away from what we use in industry for quality assurance and quality control. Like really having this data standards, having pre-written specifications, not just a SAP, but really like data specification, have double programming, like on all these different stages, and then have another, you know, like you go another loop and another loop. And then you look at academia and you, maybe we find someone who looks at my code because nobody has time, nobody has budget. I mean, it's not that I don't want to, it's just like usually the opportunities are just less. And I was thinking, that's quite a difference, and probably also quite a change from academia to industry to realize how many stages of QC you have to pass to actually get your figure in a paper.
Yeah.
That must be quite noticeable for you, Amy, having come from academia.
I was just thinking that it's so hard to get money for funding to do academic research, and then you have to provide so much output to justify the next round of applications that you put in. So it's almost built to make you just churn things out as quickly as possible. It's that publish or die. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to publish lots of things, and to do that, you have to do lots of work. And if you slow it down by getting it QC'd 2-3 times, then you're going to need much more money, but it's quite difficult to get that money. And so, it's a chicken egg situation.
This is where you need the 5-year-old.
Yes.
Well, I think on that note, we can end this episode. So I just want to thank the both of you, so Amy and Marius, for joining me today and talking about our business unit, Evidence and Value Generation. So yes, thank you very, very much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
It was really lovely.
Yeah, it was a really good conversation. I really enjoyed that. And hopefully our listeners get a little bit more, or, you know, get a better understanding of what we do in this launch space and how we do it at Verimed as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you all very much for listening. If you would like to be notified for any future episodes, please subscribe to us on Spotify, iTunes, or whichever podcast platform you're using. If you would like to know more about Verimed, please visit our website at verimed.co.uk, or you can find us on LinkedIn. If you have any questions about Verimed, or if you have any questions about EVG, you're more than welcome to reach out to myself, Marius, or Amy. We are all on LinkedIn. We are always happy to help. You can also find Verimed on YouTube and Instagram at @WeAreVerimed. So thank you all very much for listening, and until next time, see you later.